The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. This work of social and political criticism is set in Oklahoma and California in the 1930s. The story centers on Tom Joad, a recent parolee in his mid-20s. Ma and Pa Joad, a strong middle-aged Oklahoma couple. Their strange eldest son, Noah Joad. Al, their wild 16-year-old. The eldest Joad daughter, Rose of Sharon, married and pregnant. The earthy old couple, Grandma and Grandpa Joad, Jim Casey, a preacher and later a labor agitator, and the other Joad children. As Tom Joad hitchhiked his way home after a 4-year stay in prison for killing a man in a fight, he met up with Jim Casey, a former preacher who was returning from a sojourn in the wilderness where he had been soul-searching. Tom invited Jim to walk with him on the dusty road to the Joad family farm and to stay for dinner. Arriving there, he saw that the small, unpainted house was mashed at one corner, and it had been pushed off its foundation so that it slumped at an angle. The farm was deserted. Muley Graves, a nearby tenant farmer, told Tom that his family had moved out to their Uncle John's house. They was going to stick it out when the bank come to tractoring off the place. A long drought was making barren ground out of what had once been fertile farmland. Early the following morning, Tom and Casey walked the 8 miles to Uncle John's farm. As they approached, Tom saw his Pa working on a truck in the yard. Pa's eyes looked at Tom's face, and then gradually his brain became aware of what he saw. With Tom's homecoming, the Joad family unit was complete. Now Ma and Pa, their pregnant eldest daughter Rose of Sharon and her husband Connie, Grandpa, Grandma, and all the rest started packing. They were all going to California to start over as fruit pickers. Like thousands of other displaced tenant farmers, the Joads, spurred on by the promise of good wages and sunshine, sold what they could, bought a used car, and headed out on Highway 66. A people in flight, refugees from dust and shrinking land, from the thunder of tractors and shrinking ownership. After the supplies and tools were loaded into the old Hudson, which teenaged Al Joad had converted into a truck, the Joad family and Casey, 12 people in all, squeezed into what little space was left and started west. During the first overnight stop, Grandpa suddenly was hit by a stroke and died. They buried him on the roadside. Soon, the Joads met up with the Wilsons, a married couple with a broken-down car. After Al had fixed the vehicle, Ma and Pa Joad invited the Wilsons to travel with them. "You won't be no burden. Each'll help each, and we'll all get to California," Ma said. The two groups crawled westward as a unit, suffering along the way from too little money, not enough food, dilapidated vehicles, profiteering junk dealers, and overpriced replacement parts. Eastward-bound migrants warned the travelers that working conditions in California were bad, but they still pressed on toward the promised land. Crossing the border into California, the family camped next to a river that ran parallel to the town of Needles. They'd wait until nightfall to cross the desert. As Tom, Noah, and Pa sat down in the shallow river water to wash off the road grime, they were joined by an itinerant father and his son, who apprised them of the treatment they could expect in California. "Okie used to mean you was from Oklahoma. Now it means you're a dirty son of a bitch. Okie means you're scum." Later that day, Tom's aloof and backward brother Noah notified him that he was staying to live by the river, and then wandered away. That evening, after saying goodbye to the Wilsons, the Joads began the last leg of their journey. Early during the desert crossing, Grandma quietly died. But Ma waited until they reached Bakersfield before she told anyone. After another roadside burial, the family drove on into a Hooverville, one of many designated migrant camps opened during the Depression. Like other Hoovervilles, it was a chaotic community. Little gray tents, shacks, and cars were scattered about at random. But the Joads elected to stay. On their first evening in camp, two men in a shiny sedan drove up, a labor contractor and a local sheriff. The contractor had come out to offer jobs to the migrants, but when he declined to reveal the actual wage he was prepared to pay, a fight ensued. Tom and Casey got in the middle of things and managed to knock the sheriff out cold. Since Tom was on parole and couldn't afford any more trouble, Casey ordered him to hide while he stayed behind to give himself up in Tom's place. That night, before the family drove away, Rose of Sharon's husband sneaked off, abandoning his wife and soon-to-be-born child. From the Hooverville, sounds of shouts and screams could be heard as the clattering old Hudson crept away in the night. The Jodes headed south toward Weed Patch, where they had heard a government camp was located. Once there, they were immediately struck by how different this camp was from the Hooverville. Clean showers with hot water greeted them, indoor toilets, and the best Saturday night dances in the county. The camp's inhabitants had the right to make their own rules and elect their own leaders. Unfortunately, though, there was no work in any of the surrounding areas. The children began having dizzy spells from hunger, and with Rose of Sharon near to giving birth, they had to make a decision. They left the camp on their last tank of gas. As the worn-out vehicle headed north, the Jodes met a man who pointed them to possible work on the Hooper Ranch near Pixley. When they finally reached the ranch, however, they found themselves in the middle of a heated dispute. A row of policemen held back picketing strikers who shouted and cursed at the scab peach pickers crossing their lines. But the Jodes didn't care. They were hungry. Everyone except Ma and Rose of Sharon, who stayed behind to clean their filthy new home, straightway went to work. Before nightfall, the men and children had earned $1 among them, and Ma took their note of credit to the company store, where she was able to buy a little hamburger, bread, potatoes, and coffee. After eating his scanty dinner, Tom ambled down through the brush along the highway to investigate what all the commotion was about. He came upon a tent. To his surprise, he discovered that Casey, the preacher, was one of the main agitators. Casey gave Tom the lowdown. "We come to work there. They says it's going to be 5 cents. We got there and they says they're paying 2.5 cents. Now they're paying you 5. When they bust this here strike, you think they'll pay you 5? Tom was about to return to the ranch when suddenly he heard guys coming from every which way. Everyone scattered for cover, but Tom and Casey were intercepted by 2 deputies. "You fellas don't know what you're doing," protested Casey. "You're helping to starve kids." The nearest deputy snatched up a pick handle and cracked Casey's skull, killing him. In a fit of passion, Tom wrenched the club free and clubbed the deputy to the ground. As he bolted from the confusion, he received a deep gash on his face, but he managed to make it back to the ranch where he hid out. As the family worked on, the strike was broken, and just as Casey had predicted, the pay for peaches dropped to 2.5 cents a box. Soon all the peaches were picked, and once again the Jodes set out. Luckily, they happened on some work picking cotton. While they camped with other migrants in abandoned boxcars along a stream, Tom, still hunted by the law, stayed a few miles down the road in a clump of trees. At last, the Jodes were making enough money to eat properly. Then the littlest girl, Ruthie, made a mistake. During a fight with another girl, she threatened to get her big brother, who had already killed 2 fellas. That evening, Ma took Tom his dinner, told him about Ruthie's words, slipped him $7 that she had saved, and urged him to leave, for his own and the family's sake. Tom hugged Ma and promised he would carry on Casey's work of improving the workers' plight. When the cotton picking ended, the Jodes remained in the boxcar. Winter was approaching, along with the birth of Rose of Sharon's baby. The money was nearly gone. Hunger and hopelessness grew. Amid heavy rains, Rose finally gave birth to a stillborn son. As the stream swelled into a thundering river, water began entering the boxcar. The soaked, frantic, and fragmented family ran for higher ground. Finally, sheltering in a rickety barn, they found inside a young boy tending his sickly father. "Gotta have soup or milk," he told them. "You folks got money to get milk?" Bereft of her baby, Rose of Sharon now went to the famished man, bared her breast, and nourished him with her milk. it was all she had. Perhaps Steinbeck's most popular and true-to-life novel, The Grapes of Wrath, exposes the grinding hardships of the Oki migrants. With brief yet descriptive passages moving quickly from one scene to another, he conveys a sustained air of urgency. The novel is heavy with religious symbolism. Casey offers himself to suffer for Tom's crime, then later dies uttering, "Father, forgive them." The family meets up with fathers and sons throughout. The stillborn baby is placed in a wooden box and set adrift, Moses-like, on the river. The name Rose of Sharon comes from the Song of Solomon, and the list goes on and on. As a portrait of a family being destroyed by nature, mechanization, greed, and changing times, and as a sometimes sentimental yet powerful indictment of our capitalist economy, this book is a masterpiece. However, it can be argued that even through all of the appallingly harsh events, the Joad family endures. The book promotes optimism, a milk of human kindness theme, a journey from drought and despair that ends in water and hope. Though capricious nature, and human nature, cannot always be depended upon to alleviate human misery, Rose's act of mercy symbolizes the need for all of us to develop within ourselves a genuine responsibility and compassion for each other.